Good morning, Ithaca, Watkins Glen. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this morning is Gurdon Brewster. Good morning, Gurdon.
Good morning, Eric.
It's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you.
So the way we start the show is with the question, who are you? And you've lived a long, full life, and who you are may be a big answer, but take your time and give us some of the pieces of the mosaic of who you are now or historically.
Who I am? What a interesting question. Well, I suppose I could start by saying at the moment I am a minister, a Christian minister, an Episcopal priest, as well as a sculptor. And the business about being a sculptor is particularly strong in my life today because I have a show coming up at the State of the Art Gallery in Ithaca, New York, which is featuring a large sculpture, a portrait of Martin Luther King Jr., and I call it Prophetic Thunder, because rising up behind him are some 45 different images that reflect the oppression of people, both in this nation and around the world, and the civil rights movement in particular. And I show him in preaching, intense, perhaps angry, because so many of the images of him these days either show him quiet, calm, more or less happy, and I think deep down in his soul he was filled with intensity, preaching from Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. So that is on my mind, and getting ready for a show is a huge piece of work. And as you say, I've been in Ithaca a long time, so I'm a relatively older man. So that's kind of...
Okay. And I think in acknowledgement of your life in art right now, you wanted to start the show with a piece from Marian Anderson.
Well, I chose that incredible person singing Deep River, and her singing is a very important moment in American history, right at the feet of Abraham Lincoln, and singing Deep River, I want to cross over Jordan. And so this has to do with the hopes of many people, the hopes of oppressed people, the hopes of people longing for freedom and a better life. And she sings it incredibly.
Here we go.
Thank you.
And that was Marian Anderson performing Deep River. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Gurdon Brewster. So Gurdon, the way we often kind of cut into people's lives is to ask, what experience or experiences have you had that have been most formative, have been most important in shaping the life that you've lived and the things that you've attempted to do?
Well, let me first say that after hearing Marian Anderson and wondering who I am, I'm the kind of person who, after hearing her, has tears in my eyes and realizing that I am a hard act to follow her. But here I am anyway, and thank you, Marian, for singing.
Yeah.
What shaped my life? Well, going back to the art process, I lived next to a little tiny pond that I called the Clay Pond, and I would wander in there at 5 or 6 or 7 years old or 10 and pick up a piece of blue clay and start molding it. So way back when, I realized that I didn't realize it. I just picked up
just
a piece of clay and did it.
Yeah.
And then that sort of got buried because I went to the traditional schools and so on, and all the way up through school, high school, college, seminary. And being a white person from a middle-class background, all of a sudden I was launched into going down to Ebenezer Baptist Church, and I stayed with, happened to stay, it's a most amazing story, now looking back on it, with Daddy King and Mrs. King for the whole summer in a bedroom down the hall. And being a young man at the time, I sort of took this for granted, you know, that this happens to these people and to people like me and people on adventure. So I didn't, but looking back on it now, it's just totally amazing. That really shaped my life, coming from a white background in the North, being immersed in the waters of Ebenezer Baptist Church. That really shaped my life, and I began to see the world from different eyes. That has stayed with me all my life. So that's one experience that really shaped me.
And you say it's shaped. How has it echoed throughout your life? How has it shaped your ministry, your art?
I somehow see life often through the eyes of an underdog, my ministry. I was led a congregation. I was the chaplain, Episcopal chaplain at Cornell for some 35 years, and we were the first congregation in Ithaca to welcome gay people, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered. So we had a very active ministry of welcoming people, I always have looked for out for the underdog and the person who has been in some way maligned, rejected, oppressed by our culture, who is struggling to in some way make it, struggling to accept themselves, to love themselves, to be loved by other people. Mm-hmm. This is something that I have has stayed with me right through till today, with all the incredible issues of acceptance and rejection that are going on in our culture today.
Yes. When your life has been touched so deeply and so personally by these large institutional issues, which are also deeply personal issues, when your life has been so deeply touched by them, how does that affect your personal relationships with family members? It's almost hard to carry that intensity in the vessel that we have in our relationships in our homes and have it be proportional. How has that touched your
it's
life?
Let me say another thing too, because
sure.
When I got married, and my wife Martha and I went to India, and we spent 2 years in India, mm-hmm. and so I began to see the culture of India, Madras, which is no longer Madras, and the people there, and began to see the world through the eyes of Indian people, and there were a lot of poor people mm-hmm. that I was working with, and people worked in a leper colony, so I began to came back to this country and realized what an amazing country this is, and how incredibly lucky we are and fortunate, so I think of these things every day. And at this moment, the refugees who are homeless, and most of us listening and me have a home and are comfortable, and it doesn't make sense to me why some of us can be so comfortable and there are so many millions of people in Africa and Asia and other places, even in this country, who are homeless and poor and struggling. So those are really important issues for me.
Mm-hmm. But you also touched on the fact that you went as a young married couple and shared that experience in India together. Is that the way that you have helped to kind of move along by moving your family with you in these issues?
I took my wife, and we had a baby in India, and thought nothing of it, as one thinks nothing of living when you're in your early 20s.
Yeah, anyway.
And you just sort of think you can do anything. Yeah. And so it was an amazing experience having a baby in India. But I did take my family. We were invited down to Ebenezer in 1966, again, after I first went there in 1961. And I took my two children then, and we lived with the secretary of Daddy King. And so I have taken my family various places. Much to my amazement and happiness, they all four children, three girls and a boy, all turned out to be social workers of one kind or another. Uh-huh. So they're all somehow helping people and working with people and carrying on a vision of helping others.
Mm-hmm. How has your work or your ministry changed over the years?
It has changed. That's a big question, but I think I can answer it by saying that it has slowly gotten deeper, and slowly moved from my head to the so-called lower chakras. I had an organist one time who was a speech teacher, who sat up in the organ loft and critiqued my sermons, not from their content, but from what chakra they came in my body. And that sort of blew my mind as to how he would talk about that and constantly work on me getting down from my head into the lower parts of my gut. And I think over time, my ministry has because I've had so much, with all the schools that I've gone to, so much head training, and I did train as a therapist, so I've had some training that way, slowly getting down into my gut and really speaking from my heart. And that's kind of how, one way it's changed. I am also of the older generation, so to speak, nearing 80, and realize how important it is for even older people to remain creative, mm-hmm. in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in those artists and poets and musicians and even and sculptors and so on who kept being creative in their lives, mm-hmm. as they got older and older and older. And sometimes, like W.B. Yeats, the poet, and others seemed to get better and better as they got older, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like a good wine or a good cheese. And so I'm interested in encouraging people to keep being creative and to keep deepening their, mm-hmm. their lives, their creative lives, their spiritual lives as they get older.
I want to pick up on that, but first I want to go back to what you said about moving your preaching out of your head and down into the lower chakras. What did you do, or when did you notice that you were beginning to change the way you were preaching, the way you were presenting yourself and the gospel. What did you consciously do, or what did you discover you were doing as that migration was happening?
It's very difficult because it really requires one to become vulnerable. And on a rare occasion, my wife would say that I told the congregation more than about myself than I told her. and it requires becoming vulnerable, and not just quoting passages from one author or another, reading a text which is prepared. I often, by the way, read my sermons, but my sermons and my talks have to do with telling who I am and what some of my own issues are. And then what made the change happen even more is people would come up to me and talk to me about how they were moved. And you can't move people without being moved yourself.
Yes.
And so when I really can dig into my sermon and slowly move from my head lower to lower down, where I am moved myself, and if I'm moved myself, I can move other people, but that's not an easy job.
No, but it's what you also said is that when it happens to other people, it's a motivation to find that place again in yourself.
I have to keep working at it because I have been trained, and our culture has been trained so incredibly well to be strong in the thinking mode, mm-hmm. and not in the feeling mode. Mm-hmm. And what often touches people is the feeling mode, and often people don't know how to respond that way or speak that way or react that way. And so it's a constant learning, and if I was starting all over again, I'd probably be even better at it. But this constant learning to express feelings somewhat clearly, eloquently, or really truthfully.
Right. It's a commitment to be in the moment, and feelings are always in the moment. You can't. It's not like an intellectual thought or a history or something where you can go back to it and repeat it ad nauseum, and it's not going to change mm-hmm. a whole mm-hmm. lot. But a feeling is in the moment, mm-hmm. and it has to live in the moment, or else it becomes an artifact.
That's right.
And we want the real art and not the artifact, in that sense of direct, immediate engagement.
That's right. It has to live in the moment, and being in the moment. I remember I never talked about working at Ebenezer because it always felt to me as if I was dropping names. You know, I work with Daddy King, frequently saw Martin Luther King Jr., had dinner with him often. Never talked about that because it felt as if I was dropping names. And finally, one day, one of my daughters, say in the fourth grade, asked me to speak to her class about that, and I hadn't spoken to it for 10 or 15 years and spoken about it. And finally I asked the young children to sing We Shall Overcome, and I was totally amazed, and I broke into tears because I hadn't sung that with them, with those people, for so incredibly long. Mm-hmm. I realize that that's what they remember. This old man crying in front of them, holding their hands. I began to realize the power of being in the moment and letting the feelings come up. However, that is not mm-hmm. easy to do.
Yeah.
And being vulnerable is a hard thing to do in this culture, because there are always people out there who either don't like what you do or what you're saying, or are uncomfortable with where you're trying to move.
Right, right. And to be at the edge of your emotion, whether it's tears or anger or rage or joy or just a simple quality of wonder, to be mm-hmm. at that edge of emotion is it's an unselfconscious place to be, and people like to have their game face on. Mm-hmm. They like to be more presentable. And we're not presentable when we are directly available to each other.
I think that's right. And I do write out my sermons, for example, just because I don't feel totally comfortable speaking without notes. Some people are gifted that way. We all have gifts, and we have people in our little wonderful congregation in Trumansburg who can just totally talk without notes and are eloquent. That is not my gift. I have to write, and every word comes out just the way I want it. But it does take really hard thinking and work to reach down into those places where it's deep enough to make a difference to me, and not just turn out another little talk.
Right, and what you're holding on to is the difference between finding something that's so real that you can write it down and it will remain spontaneous, as opposed to something that's written down that will sound stale because it is not that real.
I have with this sculpture that I have done up in the over his head, there are some 45 different images and figures pertaining to the civil rights movement, as I said earlier, and oppressed people around the world. And as it was being cast in the foundry, which took over a year, because it's a very complicated piece, I wrote intensely about all these 45 different images, and over time, I could see I moved from kind of a narrative style to a style far more involved in stories and depth and feelings and so on. So
immediate to each element.
Immediate to each one. Yes. That's right.
Yes. I want to just tell a brief story, and then I want to come back to the creativity part. Mm-hmm. When I first got out of seminary and had my first pastoral job, I went to work as the associate to a minister who was nationally known in my tradition, and as one of the most progressive preachers in that tradition. And my first time out, I had been working so hard to learn how to preach the gospel without using a text to read from, because that was the standard that had kind of been lifted up to me by Jim Forbes and others at Union Seminary, and one of my classmates who was really wonderfully gifted at it. And I got into the pulpit without a manuscript, and I started to speak, and then I stopped. The whole thing was gone. I could not find the words, and it was my first time out, and these people had just brought me there, 1,200 miles from where I'd been, and I had to say to them, I didn't intend for this to happen, but it's what happened, and we can come back to it another day, but I have to stop. Because I can't do this. And I had the grace to just say that without getting all worked up. Mm-hmm. But it was also in a certain profound sense, and I wonder if my unconscious mind knew that I could never step into the pulpit where that standard had been established.
How hard to get into the pulpit
him. And so it proved to be more honest, though I never would have chosen it. Mm-hmm. But it happened. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Let me
roll with it.
Oh, my. Let me tell you about the first sermon that I ever preached. I was invited down to Ebenezer, got there on Wednesday morning. Daddy King said, well, we're going to service tonight. I said, that's fine. I was exhausted, but really wanted to stay home. And he said, no, we're going. So there are some 200 people there. And he said, he just walked me into the place, introduced me, gave the first hymn, whatever it was. And in the middle of the first hymn, he handed me a Bible and said, Brewster, Reverend Brewster, he said, you're going to preach the sermon. I said, when? He said, after the hymn stops. Totally. Good gracious. Totally threw me. I never preached a sermon in my life and didn't know what to say. I spent the rest of the hymn looking for the Sermon on the Mount, which was the longest text that I could imagine. I spent the whole hymn looking for it because I didn't know where it was in the Bible, and and then went down through all the different things. He blessed this, blessed that, and so on. Probably the worst sermon that ever was heard in Ebenezer, but at any rate, such was my first sermon.
No. And such was his willingness to both trust and to provoke you, and your willingness to be trusted and provoked.
Well, I don't. It could be. You're saying that very, very strongly. I don't know how much he trusted. He trusted more in the Holy Spirit, I think, than in my gifts.
No,
something was going to come.
There's not. I will ask you, and this is a profoundly theological statement. What is the difference
between
trusting in the Holy Spirit and trusting in your gifts as they're animated by the Holy Spirit? Because we don't do anything that is for the good without the aid of something greater than ourselves, and to take it into a Christian.
Well, I do believe in that, and we're coming and to Easter, which is obviously a most profound event for Christians.
And this is Easter morning when this broadcasts. We're pre-recording it, but this is Easter morning.
Yeah, so it's totally amazing that suddenly there is, for me, a release of a huge amount of power and energy that somehow spreads among people and brings together a community. Reverend King called it the beloved community, a community of acceptance, of love. And to me, this is terribly important because somehow the Spirit brings people together. There's such an amount of judgmental theology, Christianity, sensing of the Spirit today. People feeling judged negatively, trying to love themselves, and they don't love themselves. And the Spirit of the gospel, the Holy Spirit, seems to me to constantly be saying, you are accepted, you are loved, you are okay who you are, and come and join the table. And Jesus walked around the countryside bringing all of these different people in to eat with him under the table, so that the outcasts and the rejected would come and eat.
And the non-Jew.
And the non-Jews and the Gentiles and everybody, people with leprosy, people with hemorrhaging, people with the tax collectors, mm-hmm. Coming on April 15th, bringing those in to eat with him. What a powerful statement. I'm not totally answering your question, but at any rate.
Well, but you are. But what I want to just say in response to the big place you took that question is that in many of our communities, we lose sight of the fact that when we love one another, we both engage them as who they are, which may or may not be of our own religious tradition. They may be non-religious or atheist. But we also learn more deeply in loving them what it is to understand our own particular Christianity or Judaism or Islam or whatever, because the intimacy we have with another goes back to us and forces us to question and to understand and appreciate things we've almost always overlooked in our own tradition.
I think that's true, and it's a real dialogue, loving one's neighbor, loving one's enemy, loving people who are different from you. It's a real dialogue because you've got to really love yourself in order to profoundly love other people.
And you can't be defensive about the boundaries of your religious tradition or your history.
That's right, and you can't go at it.
You recognize defensiveness, we all are.
That's right. Yep. You can't go at it as a judging kind of person. And of course we are. So we're always learning when we try to love people, because sometimes we are loved and we don't feel that we're worthy of being loved. And we're sometimes amazed at that somebody would love us. What an incredible moment that is when somebody finally does dare to love us.
Right. And that is when we enter the world in our infantile way, but we also doubt that our love would have an impact on somebody else,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes. And that, when given, oftentimes serves to break us open, even as it ensures their being accepted.
That's right. It's very hard for us to acknowledge the effect that we have on other people. And the power that we have and the power that love has. And again, it, as you say, it breaks us open because it really opens us up again to vulnerability when we are really open and just being ourselves. And that's what other people want, just to be ourselves with other people who are trying in their own lives desperately simply to be themselves and to feel that they are worthwhile and valuable.
Right. And when you say be themselves, feel worthwhile and valuable, it's not a privatistic being of oneself, but it's being in the greater good, in the greater environment. It's having meaning and value to the world.
That's right. And it is, of course, a process. And we're sometimes spending our life learning how to do it and how to be. And sometimes we are better at it than others. And sometimes we fail. And of course we fail. And sometimes we have to pick ourselves up and try again and always be reminded that this beloved community exists sometimes in a reality and sometimes just a little around the corner where we're not quite there yet, but moving towards it always mm-hmm. with that as our vision.
Yes, yes, yes. And the beloved community is always outside the wall of the institution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The institution may try to nurture it and control it, but it always breaks the walls.
That's right. It always, what excites me about Jesus is he was always breaking boundaries. And it's hard to, my children sometimes laugh at me because one of my favorite stories is Peter Rabbit by Beatrice Potter. And the wonderful picture of Peter Rabbit crawling under the fence into Mr. McGregor's garden. So he's breaking the boundaries, yep. and going towards freedom and going towards the unknown, but out into the unknown, their lettuces are ripe. cabbages are beautiful.
Yes. I'm going to let you think about what song we play next, and I'm going to do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Play Report, and our guest on this hour is Gurdon Brewster. So, Gurdon, should we be with the Bach or the Beethoven or the Fauré?
Let's do the Beethoven.
Okay. We're going to the beginning of the Fifth Symphony.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Gurdon Brewster. So, Gurdon, do you want to say something about Beethoven's Fifth?
Well, we just heard a part of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I sometimes go into my studio and turn on Beethoven and turn it on loud. Incredible power, incredible energy. People sometimes refer to those notes as fate knocking at the door and as something about to be broken open and newly discovered, and then he develops into the themes that he does so extraordinarily brilliantly. At any rate, Beethoven's symphony is certainly a powerful inspiration for my feelings and thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And a companion.
Good companion.
In the shop. I want to go back to this conversation about creativity and direct experience. As you talk about the value of the kind of the direct emotional impact of relationship, you also work in a medium where you're working in bronze a lot. I think almost everything I've ever seen of yours is in bronze. Mm. And let me frame this. What I observe in your crafting the text that you will deliver in a sermon, I sense there's a parallel process with crafting the piece that will be cast in bronze so that it will speak or, in a certain sense, attract attention and engage people in a similar sort of way. Is there a similarity in the creative process there? Or, you know?
I could answer that in a lot of different ways. Firstly, I tend towards figurative sculpture, partly because I can just do figures. And my hands, all the way from way back in the clay pond, could make things and could make what I wanted to make. And it came to me really quite easily. I hardly realized it was a gift. I thought everybody could do that. And but since I have had all of these various experiences, I one of the things that I try to do with my art is to make pieces that might make a difference, and where people have some kind of an impact from looking at the pieces, and where they somehow it reaches people. I come out of a certain kind of feeling about aesthetics that in some ways art needs to be able to reach people, and coming out of my background and my thoughts and so on, I'm still trying to change the world. And so my art, in its own tiny little way, has people that in some way speak to us in ways that might move us, might affect our feelings and thoughts, and in some way touch us.
I have a friend who has one of your pieces, The Prodigal, Returning Home, and The Father. And that piece is mounted on a shelf just inside the entryway of the house. It's the first piece of art that you notice when you come in the house. It's a powerful statement of acceptance and forgiveness.
Well,
and
I did make this little piece of the whole theme of welcome home is very important to me, because I've had a family, three daughters and a son, and how to provide a home where they can be welcomed home. Kind of no matter what they've done in their lives, and no family is perfect, and we all have our struggles, and we're all trying to be accepted in our own way, and so the theme of welcome home was very important. And so, having daughters, I wanted to make a sculpture that reflected was not gender specific.
Sure.
And that reflected a father welcoming a son, of course, like the prodigal son story in the Gospels, or a father welcoming a daughter, or a mother welcoming a daughter, or a mother welcoming a son. And so there is this embrace of two two people, and who is to say the story is named The Prodigal Son, but what did the father do to maybe cause the son to want to run away?
Right.
There is in a certain deep sense, there is no guilty, and it's not the guilty person seeking forgiveness from the total sinless person, so to speak.
Right.
It is two human beings coming together in an embrace, and that's what it's all about. This embrace of these two people coming home, welcome home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The household in which it sits is a household with three sons and no daughters, and that's the way that I have associated it. What you have said, though, we are given more than we know, even if we grow up in extremely limited and abusive environments. There are options, and there are things often that we don't know until later. And some of us are just outright given access to tremendous resources that we don't appreciate. We couldn't possibly know how to appreciate them, so we're going to squander them. And that being, you know, which was in a certain sense what we've done with the environment. You know, we have a beautiful, wonderful resource, as well as a reality that defies our comprehension, let alone our control, but we are impacting it in very negative ways. And to come home to it is to realize both the damage and the opportunity. And that's a powerful story.
It's very powerful that you are reminding me that the environment is a very important issue for me. And we live on a place where we can see the fields. We have a little land, and we decided to put this land in the Finger Lakes Land Trust, which means that it is protected. People need houses, of course, but this land is protected from being either developed or destroyed or even mined for whatever one would want to mine it for. So we put it in this land trust, because I really wanted the birds and the animals and the deer and so on to have this little oasis where they could be comfortable. And my wife and I a little bit raise bees. My wife is a beekeeper, and sometimes she says the bees keep her. So it's wonderful to have a little piece of place where the bees can have their nectar and their pollen without it being sprayed, and without some of all the toxic things coming into the honey. And that's just one example of our thought of trying to keep the land, the precious land that we have, the precious lakes, waters, streams, air, pure against so many forces, economic forces, and so on that will change it all around. It's a terribly important issue, and just how to get the children and youth and college students on board that is really important in our day.
Mm-hmm. As you have aged, what is the central challenge, and what is the central opportunity? Are the central opportunities that you face in maintaining your creativity?
As people age,
as you age,
as I age, I do age, and my bones creak a little bit, and my back hurts, and I can't lift quite the way I used to, and my stamina is not what it once was. And so one of the main challenges is to keep going, and I do go to a gym where I try and maintain my strength and my stamina, but of course I have to acknowledge that I'm not young anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I'm missing part of your question, but it has to do with...
You're creative. How do you cultivate the creativity?
Oh, yeah, I just... You're up against
the aging process in your body, but what are... So that's something that you're working with in the gym that you described, is keeping your body as fit as you can.
How do I cultivate my creativity? I think one way, I mean, I sort of work with in the gym, for example, or walk up and down the road. But what really moves me is that I think I have things to say before I'm unable to say them anymore. And I have this sense of urgency. I had a heart attack in 2008. And I remember the first doctor I went to did all the tests and so on, and scared me out of my wits. And finally she said, as I was leaving, she said, "Well, you know, Gurdon, it could happen any time." And I left, and I thought, good gracious, it could happen any time, which means to say that there is a certain sense of several things. One is the incredible gift that I have been given, because in a certain sense I'm living this miracle of new medicine that enabled me to keep going after what our ancestors certainly died of before modern medicine could get our hearts pumping again. So I'm living in the aura of this incredible gift of life, and also with a sense of urgency that I want to create things and say things that are very important to me. And that's a little tiny statement of some importance, because in some ways, I'm really looking for something that's important to me. I'm not really looking over my shoulder to see what other people think of it. And I know a lot of people do that, and that's perfectly mm-hmm. okay. But I'm creating for my own, for doing something for my own satisfaction.
Right.
I had an interesting experience.
Can I jump in here?
Just because
what you said is so incredibly important and so easy to overlook. What I'm doing is a little thing. It's a little thing. Many people, when they say, "I'm doing this because it's important to me," they want it to be a big thing. And you're not looking over your shoulder, as you said, but it's also to do something for yourself when your stance towards life is a committed humility, is to do a small thing well, that somebody might actually notice it because it has accurately captured the small thing well.
What I've learned in a way is if I can be true to myself, I can reach other people. And that's the direction. I had an interesting experience in my studio one time when somebody came in and saw one of my pieces and gave me lots of compliments. And they left, and I began to think, "Oh, isn't this wonderful? They think this piece is extraordinary." And then I began to think, "Well, maybe I should make other pieces like this," and so on. And slowly I began to realize the seduction of a compliment, mm-hmm. And how a compliment can throw you off your track, mm-hmm. Because it can reflect what somebody else wants rather than what you want, somebody else's deepest feelings rather than your own deepest feelings. And so somehow, I studied with a man years ago, early on, who said, when you're young and an artist, you need to go out into the world for 7 years and make things without anybody looking at them, telling you anything mm-hmm, about mm-hmm. them, because then you begin to know yourself.
Right.
But if you go too much to the public too soon, you're just always looking at what the public is going to say to you and say about you, and that moves you and it changes. You don't really have the opportunity to get deep into your heart and soul and feelings, because you're always wondering what people behind you are going to say.
Right, right. So tell me, the question we end this show on is, what do you do on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, annual basis to restore yourself? emotionally, physically, intellectually, spiritually? What do you do, and when do you realize you need to take care of yourself?
How do I take care of myself? What do I do? Sometimes listen to Beethoven, sometimes Marian Anderson. Singing is very important to me. I wonder what singing is, what's happening with the young people these days, that we my generation knows hundreds of songs, and some of the young people don't sing anymore. So music and singing is very important to me. I like to go outside, and this morning I was sitting in this old chair that my mother bought in about 1920, all of a sudden my old cat jumped up on the arm of the chair, and I just sat there and listened to her purr. And she's been trained not to get into my lap because that's where I write. I trained her to sit in the arm of this chair, and there she was just purring, and I just put everything down and stroked her and let her purr, and somehow she was really speaking to me, and that really touched me. So I enjoy those rare, beautiful moments where things are touching me. Also, I notice that these days the birds are coming back, and there's a bluebird that looking for a nest box that we put up and is trying to figure out whether this is going to be the nest of its family, and then bringing Mrs. Bluebird for her to inspect it. And so that's just a wonderful moment of taking time to appreciate the moment that is really right in front of me, this incredible gift that we have.
What experience in life taught you to slow down enough to be available to those moments? How did you learn to notice those moments? They're around us all, but the issue is much of the time, many of us don't notice.
I'm told by a number of people that I need to keep slowing down, so I probably don't notice them enough. But clearly, standing out is my heart attack, mm-hmm. Realizing that, as this doctor said, it could happen any time. So it's not just we're all facing that in our very fragile life. People getting sick around us all mm-hmm, the time, mm-hmm. The elderly, the young, and so on. This to somehow to be told it could happen any time, to realize how incredibly fragile life is, and how miraculous it is to have a cat sit on the arm of your chair and purr. And to have a bluebird come from goodness knows where to the nest box that he or she sat in last year is just these amazing things around us. And then the bees are waking up and the birds are coming back. And life is just so, so incredible. I'm not sure what really taught me, except clearly the wake-up call of my heart.
Yeah. But you've had the capacity your whole life. From the moment as a child you grabbed the blue clay out of the pond to make things that your hands knew how to make without your mind consciously being aware of it. That's a powerful skill that you have.
I was blessed by being able to work at a young age with two different people who worked me terribly hard. Who also appreciated life and appreciated nature, but they appreciated work. I remember just talking to my brother the other day about weeding cornfields for days on end. It seemed at 10 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And then coming back to the person who was guiding me, whom I deeply respected and honored, and he went out and we were looking at bees and flowers and some of the trees that he had planted. So there was this combination of hard work and joy among the planting and the harvesting of vegetables and fruit and just looking at nature.
Yes. And it reminds me of the vision where we will plant and we will harvest grapes from our own vines and sit under our own fig trees.
Oh, I wish I could grow figs.
Yeah. Gurdon, it has been a delight to get to know you. So thank you for sharing this time with us this morning.
Well, I appreciate it greatly, and I honor the fact that this is Easter Day, and this is large in my life.
And what would you like to close with, the Bach or the Fauré?
Let's close with Bach.
Okay.
I don't think Bach wrote a bad note in his life.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you.